The race is on, and with the 2020 Formula One season all done and dusted, it's time to look back on the star performers. And of course, those who disappointed over this year's 17 races. That's right, it's time for our Top 10 Drivers season review. I'm Ed Straw, and joining me are Mark Hughes, Scott Mitchell, and special guest Gurin Chandhok.
Hello.
Yes, so Gurin, jumping the gun on the hello there. I appreciate that enthusiasm.
Well, you know, I'm just really excited to be here. It's not been a tiring season at all.
Whereas Mark and I are just sort of like, oh, for goodness sake, another podcast at the end of a ridiculous year.
Gurin's obviously not had enough talking on Sky Sports F1 this year to fill his time. So he's filling the off-season up now as well. So that's very, very encouraging. Scott Mitchell's voice you also heard there. As usual, he's in Switzerland with his telescope. Does the telescope come in handy for your top 10 drivers?
Switzerland?
Did I say Switzerland? Outstanding. Scott Mitchell from Swaziland.
This is such a good start to this already. Yes, I am at home in Sweden, not Switzerland. And yes, my telescope is in its permanently collapsed position behind me.
Excellent. There's a good competition going on for who's got the best background that I think I'm firmly losing on this. Groom's got a fine bookshelf with a helmet on it, all sorts of things. There's even a trophy there, which is pretty unlikely.
Even a trophy store.
An unlikely thing to find in Groom's house. Scott's got the telescope and various bits. I've got just a blank white wall, and Mark Hughes has still got an Abu Dhabi hotel room.
Yeah, I'm still here. Yeah, I'm just liking the sun. It's great. It's fantastic.
Yeah, well, best to make the most of it. But yeah, we should get on with it. Top 10 drivers is always a great way to have a look back at who's performed well and not so well over the season. And just to stress, when it comes to our top 10 drivers, it's about the top 10 performers based on 2020. It's not necessarily our ranking of who we think are the best 10 drivers outright, although obviously there's some correlation there. But before we start getting into the top 10 itself, let's quickly turn our attention to those who didn't make the cut. To do this, we're each going to choose an interesting disappointment for us to discuss. So, Scott, you're always good for a disappointment. Who are you going to highlight?
Yeah, but it's usually me. So, I'm going to go with Alex Albon. I've got some stick over the last few weeks for giving him a bit of a kick in. But at the same time, I was sort of seeking the light at the end of the tunnel for him for most of the year. So I feel like if I was getting criticism for being too kind to him early on and then criticism for being too nasty at the end, then I probably struck a sort of reasonable middle line. The reason for picking him is ultimately he was in the second fastest car over the course of the season and the car that got closer and closer to the Mercedes at the end of the year. Max Verstappen won twice in and even scored a pole position in Abu Dhabi. So the car was good and it was fairly well sorted by the end of the year. And it was only in Abu Dhabi that Albon actually looked like a sensible number two in the Red Bull. It was the only time he came close to influencing Verstappen's race, keeping the Mercedes honest. The rest of the year, he was either qualifying too far back, having to recover, or qualifying in a reasonable position too slow compared to Verstappen, and then falling back in the races. So it was just, he'd had such a good 2019 season, particularly at Toro Rosso, and it looked like he might belong in F1 after all, and he just never kicked on in 2020. There was just no sustained progress over the course of the year.
Would anyone like to rush to the defence of Alex Albon? Obviously, he had a tough job this year.
I mean, it's hard to defend, to be honest. I mean, I get he had the hardest job in F1. I think, you know, being number two, or not number two, but being the second driver alongside Max is arguably harder than being alongside Lewis. You know, I think Red Bull, it looked like they, as a team, they gravitated more around Max than, for example, Mercedes would have done around Lewis. And I think so being alongside Max is an incredibly hard job to do. But it still doesn't explain the fact that in terms of qualifying, his average was the worst in terms of difference to your teammate. You know, it was over half a second. I think I had 0.563 across the season, which is a huge amount, really. And to Scott's point, they don't need him. And we were banging on about this all season long. They don't need him to beat Max. They don't need another driver to beat Max, but they need someone who's 2/10 away and regularly at least fourth and doing what he did in Abu Dhabi. And unfortunately for Alex, that happened once in 17 races.
Yeah, it's very, very difficult to defend Albon too strenuously. There's clearly great underlying ability there, but it's just not come together this season. It's been a very tough year. Mark Hughes, who would you like to raise as a disappointment?
My one obvious one for me is Sebastian Vettel. In his last season with Ferrari, he's never in an easy situation, of course, because he'd been told a year ahead of time that you're not required for next year. Thank you very much. And they tried to couch it nicely at the beginning of the year, saying we couldn't reach agreement. And the first time he was asked about it, he said, no, there was no offer there to agree to. It was just I was told I wasn't required. So he just wanted that like out there in the open. So, yeah, he still maintained a good relationship with the people working on his car. But you can, you know, absolutely empathize that he didn't feel part of it anymore. But having said all that, he was so far off his teammate, and his teammate has done some astonishing qualifying laps this year. I mean, let's get that out of the way for perspective, first of all, in a bit like, you know, Alex being compared to Max, Seb being compared to Charles is a tough gig, but this is a four-time world champion, and you'd have expected them to rise to it, at least show some, you know, fighting spirit that would allow him to compete more often than he did. And I think there's probably three races really in the 17 that where you could say, no, that was all right, that was good. He requires a very specific set of traits from a car. We know that. So the car has to operate in quite a narrow window of handling traits, and this one was way out of it. So we saw the worst of him in a way. And I just hope that it sort of hasn't sent him on a confidence crisis. I hope we can sort of just reboot and start again next year at Aston Martin.
Kieran, can you put into context what it's like to be a driver who's got a set of car characteristics that they just can't deal with? I know in your case it might be a car with just four wheels is the one you can't deal with, but well, no, when you've got some limitation that maybe your teammate's capable of driving around, but it's just fundamentally limiting your style. We see this. Most drivers have some window where they struggle like that.
Yeah, but I think, you know, the great drivers overcome that, don't they? You know, and the difference is, if there's an inherent imbalance in the car, yeah, you could justify it costing you a tenth or two tenths. But the gap sometimes between the two Ferraris and frankly, the two Red Bulls, which, to be honest, the traits they were talking about were similar, weren't they, Mark? You know, Albon was continuously complaining about entry instability, and that's somewhat the issue that Seb had as well on corner entry. But, you know, I look at a driver like Fernando Alonso, who went in that era in the mid-2000s from driving Michelins where you had to just chuck the steering lock on, and then he went to the Bridgestones at McLaren in a different car in 2007 and still was successful. Then the Pirellis came along and he was immediately competitive. You know, the great drivers adapt. And I think it's a mental thing with Seb, right? You know, talent doesn't disappear. It's the hunger, the motivation to work through a problem and to find a solution and to just crack on and get on with it, really, which just didn't seem to be there this year. And the errors as well. You know, the opening lap, can't remember which one, but one of the Silverstone races, you know, that first corner spin was just, it's just unnecessary. Again, a bit like we've seen in the past at Monza and places like that, you know, Austin in previous years. So, it just looks like he needs to rediscover his mojo at Aston. I do think that the racing point, much like the Mercedes now in terms of concept with a lower rake and stuff, has got a wider operating window and is a somewhat more malleable car in terms of the aero map. And hopefully that'll just help Sebastian, you know, get into a comfort zone when he goes there for next year. So I'll be interested to see. I suppose your next question is, you're about to ask me about my non-top 10 pick. I wouldn't say disappointment is probably a harsh word, but I would say Esteban Ocon, I expected more from him this year. You know, the fact that he ended the season, you know, what was it, nearly 60 points behind Daniel Ricciardo. You know, Daniel had nearly twice as many as he did, which is a huge difference. I think particularly in the first half of the season, the qualifying gaps were bigger than you would have expected. And, you know, although Ocon came back on the in the second half of the year, when it came to the races, and Abu Dhabi was a great case in point, right? You know, they spent the first part of the race running around together. But once Daniel got ahead and got unleashed, he just disappeared up the road. And we saw that on, I feel like we've seen that on quite a few occasions, that once Daniel was released and allowed to get in front, He just completely disappeared. I mean, you know, the gap at the end of Abu Dhabi was, what, nearly 30 seconds, 28 seconds, I think. And I think I would have put Ocon 11th in my list. But on the whole, I think he'd be slightly disappointed with a gap to Daniel this year.
Yeah, I think he'd be in a similar position on mine. It was quite a funny one, Mark, wasn't it? Because normally when we pick a top 10, my methodology is always to list the drivers that I think should all be in it. And normally it's 12, sometimes 13 drivers. But actually this year, it was really easy. Yeah, and it was clear that kind of Ocon was perhaps the driver who was on the bubble, but it didn't really take more than a few seconds thought to exclude him.
Yeah, it was just unusual. I don't know. There was just this sort of little bit of a step change after the 10 drivers. And I guess it just randomly happens that way if some seasons. But yeah, it was unusual. I've usually got about 12 or 13 in my top 10. But yeah, this year it was definitely 10.
I think it's because the teammates in so many cases didn't quite deliver, did they? There was a clear gulf apart from McLaren. And, you know, we'll discuss it in a second, Ed. I don't want to hold up the top 10 chat, but I think similar for me, you know, the top 10 came up so easily because apart from McLaren, it just seemed like there was one obvious candidate from every team that deserved their place.
Definitely agree with that. And on a similar topic, my disappointment is going to have to be Lance Stroll. From the perspective of, we know how good the racing point was, Sergio Perez managed to finish fourth in the championship despite missing two races. And Stroll, you know, he's perfectly fine. He's a perfectly competent, decent Grand Prix driver, but just doesn't have what Perez has. And we saw that in Abu Dhabi. That was a great example of it. He had a few good moments. Obviously, the pole position, you know, great for him. But he's just one of those drivers who just feels like he just sort of ends up sitting in races. He's quite attacking on the first lap, but then doesn't really change the direction of his race. He just sort of goes with it, which it means he's perfectly decent. He had a decent run early on, struggled a bit when they upgraded the suspension with the feel. Missed a race through COVID, did have some bad luck, lost a fourth place in Mugello, got fired off by Leclerc on the first lap at Sochi, got flipped by Kvyat in the Sakhir Grand Prix. So he had some bad luck, but ultimately he's the reason why Racing Point didn't get third one of the reasons, I should say, that they didn't get third in the Constructors. Scott, what did you make of Stroll?
Just quite typically Lance, really. He had some very good moments, and yeah, he's a little bit of a maverick. Just the peaks can be so extraordinarily high. But he also does seem someone who, I don't know if it's fails to sort of handle it under pressure, but I think that in decisive moments, I think he can just fall slightly below the standard required, whether that's sort of acing the restart, for example, at Monza, or in Abu Dhabi when the burden of getting third in the championship sort of came on his shoulders and he just got stuck during the race. So he's just, I think there were moments this year that sort of suggested Stroll had made a proper step, especially to what we've sort of seen from him as a slightly interesting but frustrating driver in past seasons. But then there was also a familiar trend of he's just not quite good enough yet to be a team leader. So there's still quite a lot for him to prove within that team.
He set a pole position this year, which was quite impressive, and he was very impressive in the early stages of that weird Istanbul race with a very low surfed grip. But yeah, he just looks too passive. He doesn't look as though he has much to depth to his desire to change things when they're not going well. If it's going well, he'll go with it. If it's not going well, he just sort of seems to shrug his shoulders. That's how he seems to me.
Yeah, he seems to allow the struggle to keep tyre temperature right in Abu Dhabi get to him. But yeah, we'll see how he comes on next year, because he's going to have a good car next year as well. So let's get into the top 10. Now, just so everyone understands what our top 10 is, myself, Mark and Scott each put together our top 10s, and then we created a composite top 10 from the races F1 team that we ran on the site. So the top 10 we're talking about today is our joint one, and it's actually not identical to any of our three individual ones. Karun also has done his own top 10 for Sky Sports F1. I think it can be found on the site there. Same 10 drivers, similar order, but again, slightly different. So while we're not going to have any frenzied arguments about it, there's a few little subtleties to delve into, and it's a good way to understand how some of these drivers did. So 10th place, Lando Norris. Scott?
I thought it was a good step on what was already an impressive rookie season. I feel that he's unfortunate in a way that his year quite literally peaked too soon. He never matched the heights of that third place in Austria, and actually the first two races in Austria were sort of like headline grabbing charges late on to get great results, but there were some very good understated drives thereafter. I feel like he evolved into a really good leading midfield driver. The main disadvantage for Norris in terms of standing out this year is that alongside him at McLaren is just such a classy operator in Carlos Sainz. So I think Norris did a really, really good job to be the best second driver in the midfield, but just maybe lacked sort of the more of the headline grabbing peaks to merit a higher place in the ranking.
Well, I had Norris as ninth on my list. I actually had Bottas as 10th, but I think that seems to be slightly the other way around to you guys. I think Norris, his speed, I think it was very, you know, in terms of quality speed, he's very, very strong. I do feel he needs to be a bit feistier and punchier in the races. He does seem to be a little bit too polite on the opening laps and in wheel-to-wheel battle. I think he sometimes gives it up a little bit too easily. You know, I'd like to see him get his elbows out a bit more, like Max, for example. You know, Sainz started the year, didn't he, with some bad luck. He had the puncture at Silverstone. He had an engine issue, I think, one of the early races. And then, obviously, at Bahrain and qualifying, he had the issue. So, you know, the points gap between them doesn't necessarily reflect what it could have and should have been. I thought Abu Dhabi was a great way for Lando to end the season. You know, his pure race pace and tyre management has certainly improved from 2019, which is logical, I guess, in the second year. But I still think in terms of actual wheel-to-wheel battle and racing, he would... Because as soon as you lose those 2-3 places on the opening lap, you're gone. You know, you just never get those back as someone like Carlos would, who is very opportunistic on the opening lap. And I think that's something he would need to look at for next year.
Yeah, I agree with that in general terms, Corinne. But that first race at Austria, on the restart, he was superb in how he was battling. And he was, one of his battles was with Carlos, and he came out on top of it. And I was looking forward to seeing that, you know, repeated, but we never did really. So, yeah, I think he was consolidating his position, I guess. But I think there was also still, I think for the last couple of years, there'd been a general misperception about just how fast, outright fast Carlos is. So, because he was underrated, I think there was a general expectation that Lando was going to be generally quicker, and he actually can't really split them in terms of single lap pace. It's very, very close. So, yeah, I think that perception has maybe been part of that sort of, you know, everybody looking for expecting a little bit more from Lando. But I think he's had a pretty very respectable season for his sophomore season, really.
The point about aggression is an interesting one, because that was one of the things he was tasked to improve by McLaren this year. So he's not necessarily entirely delivered on that. But a strong driver. I must admit, I actually thought that his Austrian Grand Prix podium wasn't even his best drive at the Red Bull Ring this year, because I thought his fifth place in the second race was arguably better. Really good drive at the Nürburgring that should well have been third place had he not retired. And then Abu Dhabi, a strong weekend to finish off. But yeah, I must admit, I was maybe expecting him to potentially just inch ahead of Sainz on qualifying. Sainz is a very quick drive, but I did wonder if that upside was there in Norris, but it didn't quite happen. The McLaren was a slightly tricky car to drive as well, particularly in qualifying. It's quite a wind-sensitive car. And yeah, the fact that it was so even between them in terms of that often reflects the fact that Sainz struggles a bit more and there's a bit more rear instability, and Norris tends to struggle a bit more and it's a bit more front limited. But a great partnership, and the really important thing there was McLaren finished third in the Constructors' Championship, and as much as anything, that was because of Norris, as we said, as the second driver, as the best of the second drivers in the midfield, that tipped the balance. So I guess that was the important thing. But what do you think his ultimate potential is, Karim?
it's going to be interesting to see against Daniel next year, isn't it? You know, as Mark pointed out, there's still, for whatever reason, there's some question marks around Carlos. I guess because we haven't seen him in a race-winning team. We haven't seen him, you know, win races, frankly. So there were still some question marks. Whereas with Daniel, especially after the year he's had this year, we know he's an established A-lister coming in there. I think Lando's, you know, he's a great team player. He's quite hard on himself as well. You know, I like the fact that he's quite honest about coming out and saying, I didn't do a good job. You know, I think that'll pay, you know, it'll pay dividends if he can, as long as he can recognize that and work on it. You know, if he can spend the winter watching the onboards of the first few laps, for example, you know, thinking about, hang on a second, why have I found myself in the middle as I head down to turn one with cars on either side? That just means I'm going to lose. I need to pick a side. You know, just understanding and analyzing that a little bit. I think McLaren, obviously, you know, from all the good news that we got recently, they look like they will be on the up. I'd be really interested to see if he is able to take the fight to Daniel next year.
Let's move on to number 9 now, which is Valtteri Bottas. Much beleaguered driver. A couple of wins, 5 pole positions. Either the toughest job or the second toughest job in Formula 1 to be teammate to Lewis Hamilton. So, Mark, Valtteri Bottas, extensively pilloried, I guess you could say, by people as being not quite as good as Hamilton, but that's a rather harsh standard to hold him against, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, he takes the brunt for the general disappointment of fans in how one-sided Formula 1 competition has been in the last few years, which is a function of the brilliance of the team and the brilliance of Hamilton. So that's sort of taken any competitive tension out of the series. And so obviously the spotlight goes on to Valtteri as someone who should be able to offer some competition. But that's you can't just demand that. And he actually does a terrific job for the team. It is exactly how they... He delivers in the role that they expect of him. And he's quick enough to keep Lewis on his toes, but you know, you just know that over a season he will be pretty handily outperformed by Lewis. I think this year's car, the W11, has enabled Lewis to get more from it, to get more from himself, in particularly in the slow corners, and just from the traits of the car. So Lewis has been able to find even more from himself, whereas Valtteri just seems to have plateaued. It doesn't seem to have access the greater performance that's in the car so much. So he's been not maybe quite as competitive as previous years relative to Lewis, but you know, he's not a great A-list megastar. He's not Max Verstappen. He's not, I wouldn't say, at the level of Charles Leclerc or Daniel Ricciardo, any of those guys. But you know, he's at least as good as anybody else. It might be controversial, but I'd say if he was leading the Racing Point team this year, he would have done at least as well as Perez. Yet Perez's stock is sky high. It's just very different circumstances, so the perception's changed quite a lot.
I think that's a fair point, Mark. You know, I think this year has clearly emerged, hasn't it? You've got Lewis, Max, Charles, Daniel as your A-plus stars, and Valtteri's very much in the category just below that. For me, it was... I think the Sakhir Grand Prix was the weekend that really hurt his reputation, didn't it? You know, there was... And actually, fair play to Mercedes to put George Russell in there. You know, they could have done the safe and, frankly, slightly less exciting thing by putting Van Dorn alongside Valtteri. But the fact that they put George there created this buzz and this proper little head-to-head. And unfortunately, Valtteri, he didn't come out of that weekend looking as good as he did going into it. And I think that, you know, that combined with races like Portugal, where he got in front, you know, did what he had to at the start, but then the race pace wasn't there. And we've seen that, I feel, on too many occasions this season, that the race pace just hasn't been there, and the tyre management. And in terms of quality, he's a tenth away from, statistically at least, the best qualifier of all time, right? So there's nothing there that poses a question about his outright speed over one lap. It's when it comes to that relentless lap after lap that the likes of Daniel and Alonso and Schumacher and people like that, and Lewis, of course, are delivering on a Sunday. that's where it goes wrong. And I think there were two races that really hurt Valtteri this year. One was Turkey, and one was the Sakhir Grand Prix.
One of the things we found with Bottas this season is that I didn't feel like he had the sort of proper peaks that sometimes we've seen him before. I appreciate that you have to put in a spectacular performance to beat Hamilton over a given weekend, especially as I'm sure we'll discuss later, Hamilton left even less on the table than normal in 2020. And Bottas did have a ferocious amount of bad luck at times as well that definitely makes his season look worse than it was. But with that in mind, it's just difficult to... It's difficult to say he was anything other than decent this year, really, because other drivers in other teams, I guess because their cars sort of don't star all of the time, then their headline performances stand out more. You know, a podium in a midfield team obviously stands out more than Bottas doing a very good job and finishing second, 6 seconds behind Hamilton, for example. But I just felt that Valtteri was hurt early on by falling out of realistic title contention after only three or four races. And I don't feel like he ever really recovered from that. And, you know, in the interest of transparency, I actually had Valtteri 10th on my personal list behind Norris. Obviously not a lot to splitting hairs over those two positions really in the grand scheme of things. But yeah, I certainly don't think, as much as I like Valtteri and I still saw some very good moments this year, just he wasn't one of the stars of the season.
Yeah, he's just a slightly less versatile and adaptable driver than Lewis. You see that on race days, don't you? He isn't quite as strong on tyre management, a bit more wind sensitive, doesn't deal with the turbulence quite so well. And I think the way I see Bottas is that he's a very, very good driver who's a great counterpoint to show just how good Hamilton actually is. And I agree completely with Mark's point that if Bottas was in a Racing Point or a number of other teams, he'd probably be being argued to be a little bit higher, but he's got such a tough yardstick. But at the same time, yeah, he's not a gold standard driver. He's kind of in that second tier, which is no disgrace. There's been plenty of very successful drivers. And I think probably he'll, in retrospect, his career will be better respected than perhaps it is right now. Let's move on to number 8, Pierre Gasly. Let's go to Karun first on this, because this was a difference between your top 10 and our one, because I think you had Gasly 6 rather than 8, didn't you?
Yeah, I really struggled with 6th, 7th and 8th. You know, I had three drivers in and frankly, I could have put them in any order and justified it. But ultimately, I went for Gasly 6th because I thought he showed a lot of mental strength. And I think, you know, as a driver, you have to appreciate the fact that he went through torture, really, you know, last year being dragged through 2019, then dropped, then he lost his best mate in that accident at Spa, Antoine Hubert. And frankly, then this year, you know, he's doing a great job and is basically being told, yeah, good for you, but you're never going to make it back to the top team, despite the fact that, you know, the guy who's taken over your seat isn't doing the job. So, you know, he's got that baggage over his shoulder. And I think for him to show the mental resolve and shut out all of that noise was really impressive. And okay, you know, Monza was an unusual race, but for me that was actually my highlight of the season. Just that sort of underlined his recovery in Formula One terms. I think the fact that he managed to win that race, although I don't think it was actually necessarily his best drive of the season. But yeah, my 8th place was actually George Russell. I think Gasly had a stellar season. Really outperformed Kvyat for most of it. Slightly dropped off towards the end of the season. And as we said, you know, in terms of relative performance to Kvyat in qualifying, but across the 17 races, I thought he had a super season.
This reflects quite poorly on Karun, but I had Gasly and Russell in exactly the same places. I had Gasly up in 6th on my list. I don't object to him being 8th in our combined list, on purely for the reason that well, the two reasons that it was really close in that sort of area, as Karun mentioned, but also just that little dip at the end of the year relative to Kvyat sort of took a tiny, tiny bit of the shine off of Gasly's year. The bit that the thing that I really liked about his win at Monza, for example, is that, yes, it was obviously a quirky circumstance that created the opportunity, but it also wasn't his win to inherit. I thought, you know, really it could or should have been Sainz or Stroll that won that race. And I just thought it was really, really impressive and a marker of just how far Gasly has come since his demotion from Red Bull, that he was able to win that race. And he absolutely has done the impossible this year in making himself a legitimate option for the Red Bull senior team again. And inexplicably, the Red Bull senior team or the people making the decision absolutely don't want to put him there.
The thing I liked about Gasly this year is he's got a new level of consistency. He was always capable of some very strong weekends, but he was, for the most part, there week in, week out in qualifying and the race. There were some very fine race drives to less heralded positions. Eighth in Belgium after the safety car went against him. Very strong in Portugal, Bahrain. There's plenty of these kind of low-profile drives where he performed really well. Like we said, there is a little bit of a difference of opinion on this. Mark, you had Gasly a little bit lower. He was in your top 10 as well. So what were your asterisks against Gasly that stopped you putting him as high as Karun did?
I couldn't put my finger on anything in particular. I thought he did a great job. I agree he was much more consistent this year. I just think we didn't have the ultimate barometer to gauge him against. So sometimes the AlphaTauri was more competitive than at other times. But when you're always outperforming your teammate, there's sometimes a question mark about just how far up the grid should that car be. That's the only question mark I had. Sometimes when it was only at the lower half of the midfield, you did wonder, well, should it be a bit further up? Or they just, you know...
I tell you what, Mark, on that, I was thinking about this in Bahrain, actually. The first Bahrain, not Sakhir. I went, you know, it's a circuit everyone knows. FP1 doesn't really matter. It's a green track. I actually think it would have been really interesting to see Max in the AlphaTauri and Pierre in the Red Bull. You know, so Pierre and Albon, same session. You know, and both, to be fair, both Pierre and Albon have said last year the Toro Rosso was an easier car to drive. And I'd be interested to get, you know, and I wonder, Red Bull with two teams and the opportunity to shuffle drivers around, I do think sometimes they could have done with, going back to their more aggressive outside-the-box thinking, because it could have been interesting to see for a session just for their own driver feedback, for Max to come back to Milton Keynes and say, look, guys, yeah, ultimately that car's not quicker, but it is a lot easier to drive. And I think that could have been interesting to do for Bahrain and Abu Dhabi, maybe.
Yeah, that would be fascinating. You've got to convince Helmut, though, haven't you? So,
that's not an easy task. But yeah, I think probably the one asterisk against Gasly is that he struggled a little bit more when the car was a bit more understeer limited. He likes a car that rotates quite aggressively. They've actually got two drivers who have quite divergent requirements there, so that perhaps explains why towards the end of the season Kvyat had a few weekends where he was pretty strong. But I don't think it's correct to say, as some have characterised it, that Kvyat was on top at the end of the season, because he just wasn't. He just had a few, you know, good race at Imola, but Gasly had been ahead but retired, qualified really well in Abu Dhabi. So Gasly comprehensively won that rivalry. Well, let's move up to number seven now, which is George Russell. Most of the season with Williams, one glorious weekend with Mercedes. Scott, you've followed George Russell's career for a long time, since you were covering him back in BRDC Formula 4 Championship days. So that would have been 2014. So what did you make of his progress this year?
I thought it was a really important step for him, both in terms of his reputation within Formula 1, but also sort of his confidence and his development in himself. Because while his rookie season with Williams was obviously impressive, it was difficult to judge properly given how far the car was off of its rivals. And it took a good, it took until what would have been George's 22nd race, I suppose, in Formula 1 before he actually ever properly fought someone, which is an odd position to be in. So actually seeing how he fared in the midfield and in a car that had the capacity to actually do something in qualifying and in the race was important. And I think Russell stepped up to that challenge really well. He's obviously carved out a bit of a reputation this year as a one-lap specialist because the Williams was stronger in qualifying trim than in the race. But he also put in some fantastic Sunday drives as well. And then that shock call-up from Mercedes for the Sakhir Grand Prix then absolutely validated the confidence that he and Mercedes have in him and what a lot of us have seen in him in those underdog performances as well. And even George admitted in that second Bahrain race, it's nice because you do think that you're doing a mega job in the Williams and getting the most out of it and all of that, but you don't know for certain. So actually then being given the opportunity to drive the Mercedes, nearly get pole, should have won the race, absolutely underlines that he can be an absolute elite level F1 driver. But it wasn't just the Sakhir Grand Prix that we saw that from him this year. And that's why, even though he didn't score a point until he got into the Mercedes, George is firmly inside our top 10.
I mean, as I said in my column, you know, it's easy to rate George based on that one weekend. But, you know, one swallow doesn't a summer make. But I think the really important point that Scott just made is that weekend gave the rest of his season context, didn't it? You know, we didn't really have a reference because he was against a rookie in Latifi. So there was no real reference. But all of a sudden, that Bahrain weekend really gave the rest of his performances context, and we were able to then, I think, evaluate across the year. You know, again, I think his starts weren't great this season on a few occasions. He actually lost, you know, places to Latifi and often had to sort of spend the first stint trying to get back in front of him. And I think
his important one was pretty good, though, wasn't it?
yeah. Well, this is it, you know. So it's a tricky one, isn't it? Is, you know, that's the overriding memory of George Russell's season, is those 3 days in Bahrain.
Yeah.
But we've got to look at it across the 17.
I concur. It's about context. And for me, watching what he'd done in the junior categories, he did look outstanding. And then he comes in and you don't know for sure how good a job he's doing in the Williams. You know he's doing a very good job, but is it outstanding? Is it the sort of job that Lewis Hamilton would be able to do in there, or is it not quite at that level? And then you get context when he gets put in the Mercedes, and that to me looked like the driver that had dominated all his junior career and was an absolutely sensational driver. So I think the question what we had is he a good driver or is he a sensational driver? And for me, I took a bit of a punt. I've got him in the top five. I've got him fifth. For me, I think that probably was a typical performance. It wasn't just everything came right for him. And particularly the way that every single pressure point, every single thing where he could have lost, you know, through his own inexperience or our own errors, he didn't. He passed with flying colours, and he put distance on Valtteri. That performance, if you just come to watch that race and you didn't know who was in the, you didn't know that Lewis had COVID. You could absolutely assume that was Lewis in the car from the performance that was delivered. He obviously sat up a bit higher than Lewis, a bit hunched. But for me, putting him fifth might sound, you know, not, you couldn't properly justify it, you couldn't fully back it up, and I accept that. But I think in hindsight and years to come, we'd look back on that and say, fifth? How ridiculous. How could he put him as far down as that? I think I really do feel that he's something quite special.
I'd certainly agree. He's a driver with huge ability. The reason I put him fractionally lower was merely just there's still some things he needs to iron out. The starts are a tiny bit concerning, but that Williams is really hair trigger. There's seems to be about 1 millimetre between bogging down and wheel spin. They both had their fair share of bad starts this season. But the main thing that Russell needs to get on top of, and he's admitted this himself, is balancing up attack and defence, shall we say. When to attack, when to consolidate. Sometimes he underdid it, sometimes he overdid it. This comes with experience, but that's the thing that I saw when he was battling down the lower order, shall we say. And that's one of the things Mercedes had asked him to pick up on. But once he was in the Mercedes, he showed how classy he is. He's still a driver who's improving, but stunningly quick, 9 Q2s. He flattered the Williams. I think the Alpha was all round a stronger car in that Class C group at the back, and often you'd see the Williams regressing to the mean in the race because one driver getting 100% out of the car in qualifying can get it a bit higher up when others underachieve, but over a race it's harder to keep it there. So really fine season from George Russell. Let's move on next to number six, which is Sergio Perez, Mark.
Yep, fantastic season, and sort of his victory was such a heartwarming human interest story, wasn't it, given that he hasn't got a drive yet and he's doing absolutely everything to make it look like they made the wrong decision and not kibbing. But a good car, a really good car, and he's sort of maximized it, and he's done the sort of Sergio season he always delivers, but in a better car. So he's very, very good at getting the tires to, you know, do long stints. He's very good in battle. He's very good defensively. Not the last word in qualifying pace, but he's just a very, very accomplished top driver. Not quite A, but not quite B either. He's you know, somewhere in between. So I think, yeah, what we saw was pretty much what you'd expect if you put Sergio in a really good car.
I put Sergio higher up on my list, only because, again, I think that's a guy who had to mentally deal with a lot in terms of, you know, he got COVID, he missed two races where arguably the car was going to be its most competitive. You know, I think the two Silverstone races, that car would have bagged a ton of points, probably fought for podiums. I think the fact that he's basically got sacked early in the season and is still dug deep to deliver repeatedly. And he's done it with dignity, hasn't he? You know, he's not gone out there and, you know, he's put his cards on the table and he says, look, either it's Red Bull or not. He's not, you know, I feel like it could have been easy for him to be bitter about the fact that he got sacked, despite the fact that he's had a much better season than Sebastian Vettel this season. But I thought that the way he handled himself in and out of the car was exceptional this year. And you know, winning that race in Bahrain was the feel-good story of the season in so many ways, right? This is a guy who we all, I think it's fair to say, collectively believe he should be on the grid in Formula One. And, you know, he bounced back from being basically last on the opening lap. It was a sensational drive.
Yeah, I thought Perez was absolutely mega this year. I think the fact that he finished fourth in the championship despite missing those two races, he obviously had he lost third place in Bahrain through that late engine failure, and he would almost certainly have come through the field and sort of scored a lower points finish in Abu Dhabi, but his farewell at Racing Point lasted, what, a grand total of about 6.5 laps, I think. So To finish fourth despite all of that, I think it's exceptional. And I don't think, and that doesn't even take into account the couple of big scores that he lost. I think was it Spa and then Monza, because of just strategy and safety car or red flag circumstances and stuff like that. So I can't actually think of any big occasions where Perez dropped points because of something he did. I thought that he was actually utterly, utterly deserving of being best of the rest this year. And it's significant to me because he has had this reputation as, obviously, we know that he brings backing and he's a very sensible pair of hands to have in a midfield team. But he's got this reputation of being someone who is a solid driver, capable of underdog heroics, especially if you need someone with some good tyre management in a tyre-sensitive race. I actually think that this year he proved there's so much more to him than that. It's the first time he's been given a car that's so explicitly competitive as the pink Mercedes was in 2020. And look at what he's done with it. I've seen so many people criticise him by saying that Racing Point have the second or third fastest car in F1, so therefore Perez should be finishing where he is. That is not a criticism. That you can't hold that against him. And look at the difference between what a sort of solid, a good but flawed driver like Stroll did with that car, and what an all-round driver like Perez did with it. So I thought he had an absolutely brilliant this year, and I stand by what I've been saying for a long time, which is it'd be absolutely ridiculous if he's not in F1 in 2021.
I draw a comparison, and this is a slightly risky comparison given the driver I'm going to name, but there's a bit of the Alain Prost about Sergio Perez in the way he executes things now. He's not as good as Prost, and because very few are as good as Prost, he's an all-time great. But just that capacity to see the big picture, make sure he sets the car up properly for the race, manage the tyres, contain himself. But the thing that I really like about him, as we mentioned with Stroll, how he just seems to sort of sit there in races and just let it happen around him. Perez is really good within that capacity to manage the tyres, at forcing the issue and making it happen for him. He showed that in Sakhir Grand Prix when he was down at the back, didn't let his head drop, got on with it, cleared the dross at the back. And he did the same thing again in Abu Dhabi. He cleared those six Class C cars, really quickly in about 7 or 8 laps. And yeah, he's got a car advantage, but plenty of drivers take that bit longer. And if you're clear of them in 7 laps rather than in 14 laps, it makes a big difference to your race time. So that's what I like about him. Whatever the race situation, he cracks on, makes the most of it, but never seems to go into the sort of a mad attack mode that compromises the tyres or anything. It's a really fine line to tread, and that's what I really like about Perez, who does just sort of keep chipping away, getting that bit better each year. He was outstanding last year, really superb this year. Should we move on to number 5 now, which is Carlos Sainz? Karun, fine season from Sainz again.
Yeah, again, a very, very good season. You know, he had a bit of bad luck with reliability and the puncture and stuff, but I just think on a Sunday, he is a class act, isn't he? He's just so good at... I think he's very good at reading the race. Like he thinks ahead, and you often, you know, when you listen to the team radio on the Pit Lane channel, Ed, which I know you do quite often, and the conversations between him and Tom Stallard, you go, this is the guy who, in a very Schumacher Alonso-esque way, is looking at the big picture. He's sort of he's thinking already of if somebody 2 cars ahead of me is doing that on that strategy, then this is what we need to do. And also, he's willing, though, on the flip side, when the engineer tells him, trust us, this is what we need to do, he takes that on board and delivers. And I think he's very good on the opening laps. You know, you often see him making up places, and that sets up the rest of his afternoon. I think when it comes to overtaking, there's a degree of controlled aggression and car placement, which is excellent. And his tyre management, I think, has been really one of his big strengths in a way like it is for Lewis and Daniel. I think his tyre management is actually very good.
He also loves to pop up with almost a quiet drive to a good, strong result. He had 9 top 6 finishes this year. Yes, I know the McLaren's a decent car, but he's that, even on days where it could be difficult. The Eiffel Grand Prix at the Nürburgring, he wasn't happy with the car. Described the whole race as a struggle, but there he is, pops up in 5th at the end. Now, Mark, he's always had that in him, hasn't he? The capacity to put together those really strong race drives. But as he's grown in experience, he's started to do that more and more consistently, hasn't it? It's not like he does it 4 times a season in a Toro Rosso. He does it just about every weekend now.
Yeah, he's joined them up because, as Karun was saying, he's a very intelligent guy. So he understands. So you come into F1 with your data bank's relatively empty, and you know, the brighter you are, the quicker you fill them up. And he's just assumed the team leader status there as well, hasn't he? Just with not through being the big I am, just through, you know, just dependable, high performance. And his racecraft is great. He's got fantastic car control, which you only see sometimes in the wet conditions, because I think he drives below that edge. But it's there when he needs it. He's terrific. I can't remember them. I think there might have been a couple of blips where you could have said, oh, he could have done better there, he could have handled it, but nothing serious. Just an absolute top performer.
Sochi's the only one, really, isn't it?
Yeah, that was it.
Where he hit the wall. But yeah, if you look at not starting in Belgium, puncture at Silverstone, and then the qualifying issue in Bahrain, yeah, that's a whole chunk of points which really probably went out the window for him.
He also struggled with the power unit being a bit down at Silverstone over those 2 weekends, and they brought it forward, so that worked against him as well.
I put Sainz 7th on the the list that I submitted, but actually on reflection, I did him a disservice. I think he would have been, I think he probably should have been sixth on my personal list and just basically neck and neck with Ricciardo and Perez, because I think he was among that clutch of driver who, as the others have said, just so vanishingly rarely let something slip through his fingers on his own. The Russia error was horrific, and he knows that that was a bad blunder. But apart from that, you can't really hold anything against him. I remember tallying stuff up briefly, and I think he's just got he should have basically an extra 25% of his points total, but for those factors that Karun mentioned, sort of taking stuff away from him when it really shouldn't. So this was a brilliant season from Sainz in many ways. This kind of reflects well his overall career, which is that it was a lot better than it probably looked on the surface, and probably leads to him continuing to be a little bit underestimated.
He may even have been underestimated by Ferrari, who signed him for next year. I think they've seen him as a good rounded support act to Charles Leclerc, but they might get more than they bargained for. I guess the really interesting thing is he does struggle a bit when the rear end's a bit limited and a bit unstable, and the Ferrari was that this year. So I do suspect he might struggle in qualifying up against Leclerc this year, but if the car's stronger next year, I think we'll see his class. Just a good rounded package. There's no specific major weakness there with Sainz, as long as the car is decent. It was a tricky car to drive at times. Let's move on to Daniel Ricciardo in fourth place. Another outstanding season from him, Scott.
Yeah, can we take everything we just said about Sainz and then multiply it by like a factor of 1.1 or something? Because Ricciardo is kind of similar, but I think to a slightly higher level. I think I'll be honest, because I started covering Formula One properly in 2018, which was when Verstappen got a bit of a handle on Ricciardo as the season progressed. And by the end of the year, that combination of terrible reliability, the fact Ricciardo was leaving and Verstappen being in the ascendancy, meant that Ricciardo's sort of stock inside Red Bull sort of had dropped. So I was a little bit unconvinced, and I wasn't really, I didn't really buy into the fact that he was in that sort of absolute elite level of Grand Prix driver. But this season, any doubt that I had has been eradicated, because he's just put someone like Ocon firmly in the shade. And as was discussed at the very beginning of this podcast, we had higher hopes for Ocon this year. Ricciardo's absolutely put him in his place. We know he has commanded an enormous salary from Renault. And even though he hasn't been the difference between that team winning races and not winning races, he has been worth every penny they've paid him, because he's not left anything on the table. He has been an absolutely mega driving force in that team, and I've been super impressed by the professionalism and maturity as well, because while you wouldn't expect someone you're paying an awful lot of money to check out when there's a whole season to be run, the simple fact is he made his decision to leave for McLaren before a 2020 Grand Prix had taken place. And there was the possibility that took a little bit of the sharpness away from him. There's been absolutely no sign of that in 2020.
I thought that was a really good summary from Scott, really. I think he's had a stellar season. He's put himself back into that category of A-list. The years alongside Max, he did take a bit of a beating, didn't he? I think mentally as well, it was quite hard for him. And I thought last year was a year of stabilizing, learning about life outside of the Red Bull system for the first time in F1. And this year he flourished, absolutely flourished. Very, very good on a Sunday. Just that, I mean, that drive in Abu Dhabi of the weekend just summed it up, didn't it? The car wasn't quick enough, really, to be in amongst the McLarens on a quali lap. But when it came to the race, he drove a super, super first stint. The pace that he showed on a really used set of the hard tyres, you only have to look at Ferrari, who did a very similar strategy and just fell apart. And Ricciardo made the strategy work. And I feel like there's been quite a few occasions this year where, yeah, he's done super quali laps. Silverstone, the 70th Grand Prix comes to mind, where he qualified fifth. But, places like Spa finished fourth, I think, there. Just some really top quality performances. Once again, has put himself back into that A-list, A-plus list of drivers, I think.
Mark, you put a good line in your comment in the written piece about this where you said, here's what a world champion caliber driver looks like in a midfield car. Sums it up, doesn't it?
Yeah, I've never had any doubts about him since 2014. For me, he's been in the elite all the way through. And I think even when he was in his third season against Verstappen, and Verstappen had established a bit of an edge over him in raw speed, he was still able to compete with him. He's still able to compete with him over the over a Grand Prix weekend. And he didn't have the last sort of special qualifying speed but that Max has on occasion, but on a race he could do some extraordinary stints on the tires. He went into a very highly rated driver's team last year in Nico Hülkenberg, pretty much destroyed him. He's just done the same to Esteban Ocon. He would do the same to anyone that's not Hamilton, Verstappen or Leclerc, I feel. That is his level.
Yeah, and I think he elevated Renault. He was every bit worth the $25 million a year they've been paying him. Some just really outstanding drives there from him, such a classy performer. Top three now, Charles Leclerc in third place. Mark, we mentioned already his astonishing qualifying laps this year.
Oh, yeah, he's done just some beauties, hasn't he? The one at Portimao, the one in Bahrain. That car sometimes shouldn't even be in Q3 and he'll stick it on the second row. So, absolutely amazing. But then obviously the car comes down to its natural level in the race. I think he is something. We talked about that little edge that on qualifying pace that Verstappen has, and I think Hamilton has. I think Leclerc has that too. I think that's the only thing that distinguishes those three that really make them stand out. So, yes, he's had some errors this year, some bad errors for crashing into your teammate and on the first lap, and it's once he's qualified out of position, he's like desperate to make use of that and just trying for sometimes something that the car's just not going to be able to give. So he's got a bit desperate sometimes. So you'd mark him down for that on his performance this season, but not. I don't think it's a trait. I think it's just the circumstances he's found himself in.
Didn't the qualifying lap in Portugal draw a comparison with Gilles Villeneuve in a way from you, Mark?
Did a piece on that. It was absolutely like that. It was like watching Gilles with that 81 Ferrari, which he just didn't want to go through corners, but he didn't let that slow him down any. It was an amazing performance.
Yeah, and the race as well, wasn't it, Portugal? I mean, exceptional race. It's one thing to haul a car around, hanging it out for a lap to get fourth, but then to finish fourth in the race with a car which didn't deserve to be there. I mean, I thought his lap in Silverstone was excellent as well, to get on the second row of the grid there, which is a very power sensitive circuit, Silverstone, and that's clearly where the Ferrari lacked. So now a super, super drive. He had three first lap incidents, didn't he? Was it Sochi with Stroll? Obviously the one Mark mentioned in Austria. And there was another one. Oh yeah, Bahrain, of course, where he got involved with Max and Checo at the Sakhir Grand Prix. So
crashed out of Monza as well, not on the first lap, but later in the race.
Yeah, later in the race. So I think there's there's that side of it that still needs to be ironed out. But unquestionably, if Ferrari can get their act together, and they're saying all the right things, it does their power unit for next year, we'll have to wait and see if it comes true. But he's ready, isn't he? He's ready to be a championship contender.
Yeah, because Leclerc's mistakes this year were a bit like a sort of Verstappen early 2018, but like a light version of it, because it wasn't a sustained run of errors, but it was almost like as Mark said, it was a consequence of the situation he found himself in, sort of pushing himself over the limit to take advantage of what he saw as such a small opportunity or small window to make something happen. But the crucial difference, I think, between a Leclerc and a Verstappen is Leclerc just has this ability to own up to his mistakes. I mean, listen to his radio immediately after the Turkish Grand Prix. He was absolutely, absolutely livid with himself. How many times have we heard him call himself stupid or call himself an idiot and swear over the radio? And he really, really lays into himself. And this is why, which I've said, I think, a few times on our various podcasts in the past, you know, I don't think he's a driver who makes exactly the same mistake twice. I think he does learn from his errors, and that's what helps him evolve the way he has. And this season was so good that it actually eclipsed his 2019 season. And considering that was his first year at Ferrari, he won two races and he ousted a four-time world champion as the team leader. I think saying that 2020 was better is a good indicator of just how good this year was.
Yeah, I think the only thing you can hold against him is those mistakes. I don't think you can completely exonerate him from them, given that it was in the pursuit of trying to hold a car higher up the order than perhaps it deserved to be. I suspect that in a championship situation, he should calm that tendency because he'll know he won't have to do it. But that's the one downside to Leclerc this year. But the very fact that if you were to pick out a qualifying lap of the year, your basic challenge is to sift through the four or five particularly brilliant ones from Leclerc to decide it. You know, he's turned in so many outstanding qualifying laps in a limited car. He's crushed Sebastian Vettel so convincingly. Yes, we know Vettel struggles with a lack of rear end stability, but even so, the gap is enormous. And that gap was there at times last year, Spa, for example. So, you know, it's not come from nowhere, but you know, Leclerc is absolutely a class act. And he's shown this year precisely why, even before the season started, Ferrari had thrown its weight behind him as their long-term superstar lead driver for the future. I think there's a absolutely brilliant driver there, and I just hope he'll be up front fighting for wins soon. Let's move on to number two now, Max Verstappen. Karun, another fine season from him in very much the second best car.
Yeah, I think, you know, Martin Brundle spent most of the season saying thank God for Max Verstappen, because he made so many races at least interesting, you know, in terms of getting the cat amongst the pigeons against the Mercedes. But it's a funny one, isn't it? Because in Abu Dhabi, they seem to almost confuse themselves as well as the rest of the paddock of how they outperformed Mercedes. And, you know, I was talking to a couple of the engineers on the phone, and you know, there's no, yes, they think it might be this, it might be that in terms of the track and characteristics, etc. But there's no conclusive answer as to how and why that happened. I think Max could have and should have won in Turkey. You know, spinning when trying to pass Perez was an error. But apart from that, exceptional. You know, if you're talking about a driver who maximized everything they could get out of the car, you'd have to say that Daniel and Max were probably Charles were the drivers who got there on every occasion, apart from who was the obvious number one.
Yeah, don't give away who's number one yet. We haven't got on to him yet. But Mark, Verstappen, any negatives about him? And there were a few little tiny minor things, like could he have stayed off the throttle longer at Sakir and off the runoff? But, you know, they're really, really hypercritical things, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. In terms of what he drags out of the car, I think I wouldn't like to even begin to try and split him and Hamilton. I think they're absolutely of that similar caliber. I think the only way of splitting who did the better job was just how much Hamilton works behind the scenes, which is something he's done for the last probably 3 or 4 years, and how much he's actually driven the improvement of this car, the lineage of cars, and he's been pushing for certain things for years and just chipping away, and that has driven development, and that is ultimately how they ended up with a car that took a step change in performance this year, because they finally were able to figure out a way of giving him what he needed. And that's probably, Max is sort of earlier in his career, and it's maybe not in an environment where that would work, I don't know. But yeah, that's the only way I would try and sort of distinguish between them, really, because in terms of what they do in the car, it's phenomenal, and it's absolutely dependable. You just know that is 100% what the car will do, and he's an extraordinary performer.
Scott, did you give any thoughts putting Verstappen one?
Yeah, I did. Because similar to what Mark said, I found it. You are basically splitting hairs when it comes down to how each of them performed in their respective seasons, and it wasn't that it wasn't like Hamilton went for an error-free for a year, but I just felt that the thing that there was one tiny niggling little uncertainty that I had over just how brilliant Verstappen's season was. Is that he just had too much of an underwhelming second driver in the Red Bull. So while it was clear that the Red Bull was no match for Mercedes, and you know, you have a very, very, very good idea and indication that Max is getting the absolute most out of it every single weekend, such a big gap to Albon was too indicative of Albon underperforming than just Max relentlessly demolishing him. So we can never have absolute conclusive proof that of just how far off that Red Bull was. I'm pretty sure out of the any driver you could put in the other car, it is incredibly unlikely that someone would have driven it faster than Verstappen this year, but you just don't know. So and Hamilton was going up against a proven pole position winner and race winner in Valtteri Bottas. So you just have a sort of stronger benchmark basically against which to judge the driver's own extraction of performance through the season. So, but if we were talking this in percentage terms, I think it would be like a decimal point of a percentage difference between them, because Verstappen was absolutely excellent in 2020. Another step in his evolution, and while there is but still potentially a tiny question mark over his temperament, I do believe that mistakes like the one he made in the Turkish Grand Prix is still an element of having to have a all or nothing mentality, because these opportunities come around so vanishingly rarely. I do believe if he was put in a title challenging situation, he would be able to go the distance.
Well, that's the ultimate question with Verstappen, isn't it? But I'm sure he'll fare well in a championship battle. The thing I like about him is, take the second Silverstone race where Mercedes had the blistering problems. There was that point where he was closing on them and the team said, well, just sort of hold it here. And he said, no, I'm going to pressure them. And the thing that I like was Verstappen, even when it was difficult or unlikely or against the odds, he always tried to ask questions of the Mercedes drivers, which I think is a great sign from someone determined just to, if the door's just a tiny bit ajar, he's going to pile through it. And that's really important for a driver. And that's what I enjoyed about him this season. But yeah, when it came to that number one versus number two decision, I'm sort of in the same place. It was so marginal, but Hamilton just that fraction ahead. Did you think about Verstappen number one, Karine?
Briefly, but I just found it hard to find any chinks in Lewis's armor this year. I think actually on reflection, now listening to Scott, he's probably right. You know, I think there's an element of Verstappen maybe being frustrated. You know, he's what now 6 years into his F1 career as a driver who we all believe to be one of the top two in F1 consistently, and he hasn't had a chance to fight for the championship. You know, if you look back across the great drivers in F1, you know, Schumacher, title contender and championship winner in his third full season. Prost was a title contender early on. Senna was a title contender. You know, they were all Lewis straight away a title contender. Max hasn't had that opportunity, and there's a bit of frustration, I guess, in that. You know, he's trying to make things happen. But I just thought Lewis this year, he was just on another level in terms of consistency. And you know, the easy ones to do are point to obviously races like Turkey and things like that. But you know, even just his qualifying laps at Spa, for example, you know, I remember watching at the the Fania chicane, and he went through the right-hander. And as he turned into the left, the back of the car does this sort of shift. But he's just, it's balanced. You know, it looks, you watch him and go, wow, he's about to either have a spin or lose time. But he doesn't. He holds it there. And he's just got this amazing touch, which he I think to Mark's point earlier, he's now understood how much he needs to work on the trade-off between setting the car up for qualifying and the race and then driving differently to manage the tires and make the strategy and make the car and make the setup work. And I just feel he's turned, although he goes on about the fact that obviously Senna was his all-time hero, I feel like there's a Prost-esque approach in Lewis's driving since late 2018, I'd say. You know, I think back to that Mexican Grand Prix that he won, you know, against the Ferraris 2018, just again managing the tires last year, I think it was actually. And I think that's just a Prost-esque methodology that's come into Lewis's armory now, which he didn't have before.
I'm disappointed by this because I think Karun's given away our number one, and this is how I find out that my pick for Daniel Kvyat has been ignored.
Yeah, you just didn't give him enough points with your tactical voting. But yeah, Hamilton obviously is number one, and Karun started off the conversation very, very, very well there. But we've talked a lot, Scott, on this podcast about how good Hamilton is, but while it may seem a bit repetitive, he just is, isn't it? And there's this whole, oh, is it just easy in a Mercedes? But the contribution Hamilton makes overall, not just in what he does on track, but off track, the whole thing, just can't be underestimated, can it?
No, not at all. And it's been really interesting, actually, listening to various Mercedes people this year, including James Allison and Andrew Shovlin, about one of the features that Hamilton has, which has been so valuable in 2020, is this maturity and calmness that he's developed in key moments during a Grand Prix. And we saw it a few times where he is able to play the long game, and those are slightly more nuanced moments than we'd like to see. We'd obviously like him to be faced with races like Turkey every week if we can, so we can actually see it properly on track. But it's things like in Portugal where the race is a little bit weird in the opening laps because of the lack of grip and a little bit of rain in the air, and Hamilton falls back, but he doesn't panic, and he just sort of slowly goes about piecing his race back together and eventually unleashes a level of pace that someone like Bottas just can't go with. So Hamilton has made the difference, and I think Verstappen put it really well when he was asked, because of obviously Russell was absolutely mega on his standing performance for Mercedes, which obviously fed the critics who believe that Lewis's stats are padded and that he doesn't deserve the success that he's got. And Verstappen was among those asked, sort of, does this justify sort of Merck doing whatever it can to keep Lewis in the car? And Max said, yeah, of course Merck should do that, because Hamilton is a seven-time world champion, because he makes the difference when it counts. And we saw that plenty of times in 2020. It's just something that F1 needs to change, because while you can still tell the story of how he made the difference and why he is so good, it would just be nice to have more sort of anecdotal evidence on track where he's sort of had to fend off Verstappen or Leclerc or somebody in a straight fight, other than just roundly destroying Bottas over the course of a season yet again.
The thing I really like with Hamilton this year, the race that stood out for me actually was Spain. He talked in the race after it about how in the zone he was and just how close to almost perfection it was. It just shows how completely in control he can be. And just to see a driver, boring race ultimately, won by 24, 25 seconds, but just a driver excelling and just so on top of things is fantastic. We saw that regularly this season, but Spain bizarrely stands out for me. But Mark, final word on Lewis Hamilton. There's very little new we can say about him, really. He is that good. Yes, his stats are helped by being in the best car, but you've still got to be the driver capable of capitalising on it and contributing to it being the best car to do that.
Yeah, and I think he adds new strings to his bow all the time. He refines his whole game, and it gets better each year. And this year, his qualifying was better than last year, I thought. And then when there's an opportunity to do something really special, such as in qualifying for the Styrian Grand Prix, he goes and pulls a lap like that, which is 1.2 seconds clear of the field. in appalling conditions. So it's still very much there beneath the velvet glove. So yeah, just amazing, outstanding.
Statistically, the greatest Grand Prix driver of all time, 7 world championships now. Every chance to get the 8th next year, and we'll be sat here in 12 months talking about him being number one again. But hopefully he's pushed a little bit harder, but you can't blame him for the competition. And no matter who he's up against, he's going to be an absolutely formidable competitor. So just to recap our top 10 in reverse order, was 10 Norris, 9 Bottas, 8 Gasly, 7 Russell, 6 Perez, 5 Sainz, 4 Ricciardo, 3 Leclerc, 2 Verstappen, 1 Hamilton. You can find our collective top 10, myself, Scott and Marks, on the race.com website. And don't forget the hyphen. And of course, Caroon's top 10 is on the Sky Sports F1 website. So thanks very much for your input. It's always an interesting process to work through the best performers of the year and rank them. And do let us know on social media if you agree or disagree. Do head to the race website, as I say, to see what we've had to say there. Check out our sister podcasts, including Bring Back V10s, which tells classic F1 stories. All four of us occasionally turn up on that. And also check out our YouTube channel. Just search for The Race. We'll be back soon with another episode of the Race F1 podcast.